Bienvenue dans Négatif, le podcast qui donne la parole aux créateurs et créatrices d'images et de sons. Deux fois par mois, nous vous proposons un grand entretien avec une personnalité du cinéma, du son ou de la photographie dont le travail artistique nous a marqué. Je m'appelle Thibaut Elie et aujourd'hui nous allons découvrir l'univers d'un duo de réalisateurs, deux frères jumeaux, artisans de l'animation et rois d'un royaume enchanteur. Une fois n'est pas coutume, un entretien dans leur langue natale, l'anglais. Bonjour Stephen and Timothy Quay.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
You are commonly known as the Quay brothers. You are born in Philadelphia, in the US, but you are nowadays crafting movies in your London workshop and studio. Your first feature film, Institute Benjaminta, made in 1995, got a new release in France on the 4th of December. 10 years later, in 2005, you made The Piano Tuner of Earthquakes, another feature film, this time about a murder in a 19th century opera. Your movies takes inspiration from a wide range of sources, Eastern European literature, South American magic realism, surrealist and expressionist traditions, classical art, especially music, and many more. We will discuss it later. Your work with stop-motion animation style is what made you famous as filmmakers. Music videos for Sparkle House, Peter Gabriel or Père Ubu, commercials for Coca-Cola, Badoit, Fox Sports or MTV, and many more, and thousands of short movies by the names of Street of Crocodiles, In Absentia, The Sandman, The Cabinet of Jan Swankmajer, or latest in the row in 2019, The Doll's Breath. You also did work with theaters and opera production, designing large-scale sets and decors. Well then, Stephen and Timothy Quay, the Quay brothers, your unique world composed of puppets and machines, your vision of cinema and the arts in the 21st century, the power of sounds and images, we will explore all these dimensions of your imaginary world with you in this new grand entretien de Négatif. First and foremost, Stephen and Timothy, which word should we use to describe what you do in your life?
I think that probably what we're looking for is, and there's an expression, the conditions of enchantment. So I think that we're searching for the marvelous, the hidden. It's those kind of dimensions that are on the margins. They're not, you see them out of the corner of your eye. They're small epiphanies that happen.
So you're enchanters? You're not directors or animators?
You know, because I don't think we have to remind ourselves what we are in the creative process, because there's the two of us, there's a studio, there's the table where we create you're trying to create the marvelous, and you don't really think about it's a job to be done, and I don't think we put any big spotlights on the process. It's just we get up at we're in the studio at 4 a.m. and we work till 7 p.m. It's a long day, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Is this a job or a craft for you?
Craft is a kinder word. I think it's an artisan. It's the métier of an artisan is because it's very skilled work in a way. But I think there's always a kind of modesty the way we approach our work.
Your twins, are you doing you two the same work?
I mean, essentially, because we've grown up together, we both know how to hold a pencil, how to. It's what you do with that pencil, or what you do with in terms of conceiving a scenario or animating. But it's always a talk between the two of us. I mean, there's never one second where there's not some form of collaboration to making one single object. So we both do the decors. I mean, all the different métiers within the puppet animation, it's something that whoever makes the puppet animates that puppet. That's the one distinction that we make, because that person has come to terms with the fictional character that he's working with. So that's probably the only delineation.
Do you consider your work as animation?
I think, well, there's a quote that Robert Walser, he talked about a Zwischenwelt, which was an in-between world. And I think that with us, with the animation, I think it's trying to create that in-between state that it isn't live action, but it isn't necessarily puppets, but of course it's both. So I think the important thing is to make it invisible between whether it's sometimes live action or animation. You can't be sure.
You're trying to get out of the cinema medium some of these most magical properties, maybe?
Yeah, ideally that you're searching for that something you didn't expect. In other words, when you're staging a scene, you have a certain hunch, an idea of where you're going, but I think what you're always looking for is the chance encounter, that moment where forces coalesce that you didn't quite expect, and that's, so you're there to kind of trap them, and that oftentimes makes the film go a little bit to the left, maybe a little bit to the right, or a little bit under. So in a way, as we've said, the studio is like a laboratory where you have the right, and you also have the opportunity to experiment and discover. That's the most important. And on top of it, no one is looking. It's just the two of us.
Are you doing fiction, documentary, or experimental movies?
Sometimes it's a little... We've done documentaries. At other times, we've tried to do a more experimental, sometimes fiction. But then I think every film has a mixture of both. So there's a mélange.
Are you also storytellers?
Yes, I think modest storytellers. I don't think we're not interested in telling big dramas. It's very quiet. It happens in the wings of in the shadows. That's the dramas we like, the small ones.
Shadows, storytellers.
The half-light.
Your first feature film, Institute Benjaminta, made in 1995, narrates the story of a butler training school in which the same and only lesson is perpetually delivered. Jacob wanders through maze-like corridors of the Institute, trying to unravel the mysteries of the lives of the agar occupants of this strange establishment. In 1995, you already made a great range of short animated movies. Why did you jump to a longer format, including real human actors?
Well, we had just finished Crocodiles, Street of Crocodiles, and our producer just casually mentioned, had you ever thought of making a feature film? And we said, absolutely not. And we were rereading Robert Walser at the time, and I think we looked at each other and said, this could be potentially molded into a feature film with actors. And we've always watched live action films, and we even watched films on television. So there were various people that we saw out there that we thought, yes, if we could get such and such a person to act, that we would feel that we could contribute towards a live action film.
As you said, the movie is based on the novel by Wovel Walser, Jacob von Gunten, written 1909. How to adapt such a story from a marginal writer to a film?
I think that it was, I think we like interior journeys. And this was one where a figure like Jakob was quite mysterious. He enters this institute and for us, it was first off a kind of an architectural space which had a former life, and what you feel in the Institute is that there it had many previous lives. So there was a contamination of elements. For instance, we said it was a factory for making perfume, but perfume comes from musk, which comes from the deer. So Walzer also worked with very much the genre of the fairy tale. And I think that the animal kingdom is a layer to the fairy tale. And I think when you, there was that whole subjective side too, to Jakob's world that attracted us. And so that was, I think that was just the starting point. And then we just sat down with our friend Alan Passis and we just worked through an idea of how we would approach the novel, but knowing that Walzer also was very, he created a lot of monologues and a lot of subjective voiceover. So I think we set off immediately trying to see the film almost as a silent film with music and sound and occasional voiceovers, which would help establish the subjectivity of the material.
Are you writing a script, a scenario?
Oh, it was a very detailed script. With the animation films, we don't really, we write a basic script, but it's not, and we never do storyboards. But with this one, we realized we had to write a very detailed script in order to get the funding for it.
I know that on the, in writing the final scenario, that we gave very precise lighting conditions for the future cameraman.
We're going to listen to a first extract taken from the beginning of the movie.
It's the one thing that we asked of Leszek Jankowski,
the composer of the music.
Of this music, that we gave him a text about how a text of Robert Walzer of how the fork should be held, and we said to Lech, it would be great if you compose something for a children's chorus, and that's all we said. And then when we visited Poznań to talk and just to, he invited us into this room and there were 68 kids and they all stood up and they sang this piece to us. So it was a bit intimidating, but then afterwards he had a double bass player improvise the double bass over top of the chorus, the children's chorus. But it's beautifully austere and really sets the tone for the film. There was also a small piece of music at the just before it by, it was one of the children's songs by Karl Orff, and it was called The Riddle. And I think that really sets the whole tonality of the film, this riddle.
In your movies, do you always get the music before starting shooting?
I think, no, for sure, the music always comes first. There's only been one film where we didn't have the music first and we were panicked, in a total panic about that. But it's a precondition that we have the music first.
And I think the reason for that is that we've always, there's this quote that, I think we quoted Bergman, where he said that our films obey musical laws rather than dramaturgical laws. And I think the idea that the music creates a fantastic force field, in a way it frees the image and it also makes it independent of dialogue. And, you know, the notion of choreography, that we feel much more comfortable in the sense of choreographing movements like a choreographer.
Talking about choreography, you worked with actors in this movie. In your short animated movies, you work with puppets. How is it to guide, direct actors in a feature film?
Well, it's certainly easier to guide live actors. Puppets, I mean, when you make a camera movement with puppets, it takes us hours because it's, we always say there's, the third puppet is the camera. And so if you're doing a tracking shot or a crane shot, I mean, it's all about mathematics. And that is a protracted exercise. With live actors, you know, you really get them, you show them the frame, and then the intention is to elicit, to bring out a response from the actor, that they offer what their conception of their character is. With the puppets, we impose a performance. We're manipulating them. But for us, there's no confusion that we don't treat the actors like puppets.
About camera work, you work with Nicholas Nolan, the cinematographer. What was his contribution to the movie?
We were given the opportunity of interviewing three cameramen by our producer. We had seen some of his work for a number of ballets, and they were in black and white, and we were already attracted to him. And the one cameraman that we interviewed had done the last Hitchcock film, and we had this interview with him in which we said, can you conceive of filming theatrically? And he said, why would you do that? So we crossed him off instantly. In the end, it was Nick Nolan who was absolutely coincided with us, and he was also a great lover of Belgian beer.
No, I think it's, I don't know if he, I think we talked to him about Carl Dreyer, like Vampire, and we said we wanted the purest whites, the richest blacks, and then the most beautiful grays imaginable. And after that, we didn't have to say a thing. He just...
Because the movie is in black and white.
Yeah.
And grays.
I mean, he knew from the beginning it would be in black and white. He made some very good camera tests that we sat down and worked out. But it was quite magical what he did. And we... you didn't have to say a lot. He understood it.
You are cinematographers of your short animated movies?
Yeah, we do. So because we can't afford anybody.
So you do the lighting. So you are lighting experts too?
Well, we've learned a little bit of the craft of lighting, but I would never say that, you know, Nick Nolan was a real master of the craft of photography. Yeah.
Did you give him directions or did you just watch him do his work?
Because in the script it was very clear. We would say what the general feel was, whether it was night, whether it was late afternoon, the quality of light when you see the fishbowl. And he spent a lot of effort working on that scene. And no.
The thing is, with the Institute, you could never tell day from night because you felt secluded. There was a penumbra of darkness surrounding this place. So it was always, you couldn't say it was dawn. There was no light, there was no sunlight coming in. It was always a kind of magic hour, yes.
Is your camera in this movie, in this feature film, another kind of character too?
Probably less so, because in a sense with live action, you think the camera's sort of invisible, whereas I think in animation, you don't expect a lot of vigorous camera work or tracking shots, because they are a lot of people have what they call go motion, so they can just type into a computer, the camera will move at a certain speed. We've never been able to afford that kind of equipment, but for us, I think there's that humbleness of getting down on our hands and knees and one of us pushing the camera 1 millimeter. That humbleness is important to the craft of, not sure we answered your question.
Kind of. Did you work alone on the craft of the decors of the sets of the Institute?
No, we entirely handpicked the whole team. We had Alan Starsky, who was a Vida's set designer, and he was on board, but the film didn't. We weren't able to get the contract out to him, so we lost him. So he had an assistant who was an Australian girl, Jennifer Kentke, and we used her. But she followed, I mean, we gave her very explicit things, but she made some beautiful contributions herself. So we had enough work to do with the actors, and so she handled the production side of it.
We gave her an enormous amount of reference material from books.
Architecture.
Yeah, architecture books, exactly. So she knew exactly what we wanted.
And we also rode around together to antique shops or secondhand shops and markets to find, you know, certain kinds of details that might be in the Institute. It was very hard not to be, to want to have your fingers on everything.
It was more a collective movie.
Yeah, but in animation, it was, you know, as we said, it's the two of us. But with this one, the team really came together. It was sort of a pleasant surprise to have that kind of freedom and everybody helping out. And for two people for their first feature film, you couldn't have had a better situation.
Did you want to make a politically engaged movie with Institute Bergamenta?
No, I don't think that's not our forte. Yeah, it's not Robert Walser. I mean, yes, maybe. I mean, the idea of staying small is an act in itself, becoming a zero. But I think by becoming a zero, you pass through the middle of that zero, and there's a lot that is available mentally, psychically, and in a sense of discipline that we liked.
How your movie was received by the public in 1995?
I think there was a bit of admiration, but on the whole, it was considered highly uncommercial. And we have to admit that the film was really, to our surprise, respected here in France. It took off in a way that it never happened in England or America. But I think in a way it became a quiet, I think it was admired for the fact that we stayed true to the world of where we come from, the world of animation, but at the same time, it's a leap to another plateau. Yes.
Could Institute Bergamenta have been told in a short movie of 10 or 20 minutes?
Well, we did a pilot for Institute Bergamenta, which was The Comb, which we did in 1990. And then we also did another sequence for it, which we actually used in the film. We did that in 1993, and that was Stillenock 3, which explored some of the deer imagery. So in a way, we did court the fairy tale idea of this prince on the edge of a forest coming to awaken a kind of sleeping beauty figure. But the feature film needed, you know, needed the flesh of 90 minutes.
Was it difficult to edit?
It wasn't difficult because in a way it followed pretty much the way it was written in the script, although there was we made a few abbreviations and we cut some scenes and out entirely, and then we transposed a couple of scenes that should have been later in the film to earlier and vice versa. But on the whole, the music really established the trajectory.
So let's talk about the beginning of the Quay Brothers. Do you remember the first images that affected you?
Well, I think it as kids, our parents used to take us in the summer to a mountain area called the Poconos, which had a sort of these beautiful old cabins. And behind the cabins there was a very deep forest. And I remember that we would walk out amongst the forest and you'd suddenly see a deer. It was quite magical. So I think that left.
No, I think the important is the sense of going into a forest and how you smell the forest with your eyes shut. But I think the forest became a real symbol of potential and the hidden, what would come from.
So this is a sensitive relation to the world. Because when I say the images that could have been, I don't know, paintings or TV or cinema, but you said forest.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. As children, we were brought up on TV. It's not that we've forgotten certain images, but we watched a lot of junk. I think that was early television, so it was black and white.
We were only allowed an hour a day.
Yeah, parents limited our watching to an hour a day. But, you know, we saw some Disney, you know, we probably were a little touched by it. And I remember that even our grandmother took us into Philadelphia to see one of the Disney films, and that was an event.
In the theaters?
In a big cinema.
Pinocchio,
yeah. Which is interesting because the opening sequence is multi-plane, so maybe that stuck with us, that sense of depth.
If you didn't watch a lot of TV, did you read a lot children?
As children, I don't think we read that much, but we drew constantly. And I know we did either Westerns, cowboys shooting Indians, which should have been, I think we actually had Indians killing cowboys. and we did a lot of architecture drawings. We were fascinated by, I remember at one point being stunned by Frank Lloyd Wright, seeing something of his, and then suddenly we drifted towards doing little drawings of architecture.
Also, I remember we had those games where you actually build things. So there would be, you could assemble something in a thousand different variations. And I think that used to occupy us quite a lot.
But we didn't collaborate then.
When you were teens, not children, did you go more to the cinema and read more literature?
I think it was when we went to art school in Philadelphia that we had a teacher who had a fantastic 16mm collection, which was the reason why he was hired. He wasn't really a certified teacher, but his enthusiasm was fantastic, and he showed a whole range of international foreign films, as well as his favorite was the English cinema of the time of, say, Carol Reed, Lindsay Anderson, Hitchcock. We saw everything of Hitchcock. But then he showed us Buñuel, early Buñuel, Dreyer, that was Day of Wrath, Bergman, so some Fellini. So it was a, and then also just outside of Philadelphia was this quite extraordinary repertory cinema that played two films a night, double bills, and this man played lots of films from Eastern Europe, the Czech New Wave, the French New Wave, and the early Russian cinema, you know, Parajanov and Tarkovsky. So all of Bergman's films, Antonioni. So in a way, we had by the time we left the Philadelphia College of Art and came to the Royal College of Art, we had a lot of cinema under our belt. I know that when at the Philadelphia College, we would read a certain, there were two magazines, they were Swiss, Grafis, and that's where we discovered the art of the Polish poster. There was also happened to be an exhibition of Polish posters. The word Kafkaesque came up, and I remember we went up to the librarian and said, "What does Kafkaesque mean?" And he said, "Well, look it up in the dictionary." So he gave us a dictionary. We looked it up, and it didn't exist. And then, like days later, on the library shelf, we saw the diaries of Franz Kafka. So we immediately took those out, and that opened up the world of Kafka to us as well. So there was a good simultaneity of things.
Misconnections.
I think it's also where with Kafka and the diaries was this whole fantastic element of where it was, he would begin a story and it would just cut off, or he'd make a little fragmentary description. And it was that feeling there that where the fragment felt not incomplete, but absolutely complete. And I think it was something that we really admired. And I think we've always taken it into our world that the fragment can be just as powerful in its incompleteness, but feeling complete.
And it was in the diaries of Kafka that we first ran into the man, Robert Walser. He had been reading some of his feuilletons, and Kafka laughed uproariously at them. So there was our introduction to Walser.
What about music? What did you listen to at the time?
One thing was that our mother was a figure skater, did ice skating. So she always had a collection of classical music that she used to skate to. So there was always the standard, the Tchaikovsky's, the Nutcracker Suite, that kind of thing. As we slowly, you know, got to know a little bit more about music, that we discovered Stockhausen and at the same time Debussy, Ravel, and it was just a slow exploration. We'd listen to the radio and took notes, and the works of Janacek, and the final year at the Philadelphia College of Art, we had an English professor who was visiting and taught for the final year, and he asked us what we were doing, and we said we were interested in maybe doing some filmmaking, to study film. And he said, well, we mentioned that we wanted to go to the London School of Film Technique. And he said, I suggest you show your work at the Royal College of Art. They have a film department. Show your illustration, graphic work, and then you'll transfer. You can make a transfer. So we got into the college. And then when we tried the transfer, they wouldn't let us. But maybe that was a good thing that... But while we were there at the Royal College, we made three cutout animation films, because by then we'd seen quite a bit of work by Jan Lenica and Borovchik, their early animation films, which made a big impression on us.
So that was the origin of your decision to do animation?
I think it was, because I think it was that idea that Paul Klee said, to take a line for a walk. And I think it was just a hunch that we just wanted to explore if what animation was capable of. And puppets came much later. I think that after the Royal College of Art, we came back to America to pay off our debts. And while we were there, we made a lot of drawings individually away from each other.
Posters?
The black drawings.
For posters? Or for?
No, they were individual, like, compositions for in pencil, but they were quite dark, and we called them in an offhand way, we called them the black drawings. We didn't have any other idea for it. And we sort of saw it as a kind of failed cinema, because you almost imagined that they were imaginary settings for the cinema. But of course, they had no sound, they had no depth, we couldn't use music. So in a way, I think what we were working towards was the realm of puppets, which we thought there we could work intimately, as we've talked before, on the tabletop. And that's really when we had the chance, when we returned to England after paying off our debts, that's when we first got a grant from the British Film Institute, and we said we'd work with puppets, and that's how it started.
Who is Case Griffiths, the producer of your first films that you met in the Royal College of Art?
Keith was a student also at the Royal College, but he was in the film school. We weren't. And so at one point at the end of the third year, he said, "I have to make a film. Would you like to have my money to make it?" We both thought, this is mad. We chose not to. But when we went back to America, we corresponded. And when we came back in 1979, he was at the British Film Institute working. And he said, "Why don't you write an experimental film?" And typically being, we didn't want to be... We had no conception of what an experimental film was. So we said, okay, well, we'll write something. We went to Amsterdam. We wrote a puppet piece and sent it back to him. And then he said, 6 months later, you have the money, make a puppet film. And we hadn't the slightest clue how to make a puppet film. So it was a journey of discovery and failure. But at the time, there was no internet, so you couldn't research.
So how did you learn?
How to do it in a very quick manner, like you could do now.
How did you learn then?
there were some books, and there was in fact one woman who we found out was working at one of the production companies, who was Czech, and she'd worked with Jiří Trinka in Prague. And so we managed to meet her, and we talked a lot, and it all helped to sort of build up an image of how you make a puppet film. And again, it was done very slowly with lots of mistakes.
What kind of mistakes?
Like the film coming back completely black, like not having enough light. So again, instead of having a black drawing, you had a black film.
Is the first mistake of a cinematographer.
Yeah, exactly. And then you realize that animation is very time consuming. So you learn very quickly not to make mistakes like that, or as few as possible.
But also it was something where you realized that patience could be tremendously rewarding, that it has to be probably one of the slowest crafts, métiers in the world to do an animation film. But that's what we chose, that's what we had to submit to.
And like drawing animation or computer-generated animations, you have to deal with a real camera. How did you learn to shoot with a real camera?
Well, I mean, even at the Philadelphia College of Art, we would hire, you got people to teach you how to load, to load the film and unload it. First working with 8mm, but then at the college we worked with 16, and then at the Royal College, more 16mm. But I think the step up to 35 millimeter when we first did Street of Crocodiles was that moment when you suddenly realize that the craft is very serious now, and it could be very beautiful. 60 millimeter always felt a little bit like a hobby or something slightly inferior. I know it isn't, but 35 was special. Yeah.
Did you quickly do complex, difficult camera movements?
We did. Yeah, I think we did. I think you rose to the occasion. So the move from 16 to 35 made you more ambitious. You know, you tried things out.
And bigger cameras too?
Yes, particularly.
We had with 16 mil, we had a very small tracking device, which was the width of a table, and you could only wind up about 10 centimeters. But with the 35 mil camera, we got one of those old fashioned, it's a television tripod, and which we had somebody make a kind of geared head so you could animate it a single frame at a time. So that was a discovery. That was important to how you can embellish a film with a tracking shot or a crane shot. Or
you talked about mathematical.
I would spend hours doing the mathematics of
how does it
going
work?
Up, tilting, and tracking forward, and arriving at the exact precise moment. So many mistakes.
And if you make a mistake, you have to start over again.
Yeah, start over.
Is cinema first and foremost about rhythm?
I think the sense of rhythm for us comes from the music. So immediately when the film comes back, we are always doing the montage simultaneously. And you can see instantly whether that sequence that you had in your mind rhythmically works with the music. If it doesn't, then you reshoot or you rethink how to do that.
Was it difficult in the early days to make a living from your work as an artist?
In the beginning, yes, you really had to, because at the time when we were living in England, from say 1978, we were Americans who only had 6 months to stay allowed. We were only permitted 6 months, and then we'd have to renew our passport. So it meant every 6 months, we either had to fake or somehow say that that we had a job, a new commission. So Keith was constantly protecting us because we were quite vulnerable to being thrown out or just saying get out of England. But then after about 7 years, we got invited to become English citizens. So it's okay now, we won't get thrown out.
But is it to make money out of short animated movies?
I think Keith, you know, it depended on the scale. Like Street of Crocodiles we had a substantially good budget that we could live and work for, say, 2 years.
For 20 minutes animated movies.
But it was on the strength of Crocodiles that we had a projection of Crocodiles and one of the other short films. And the day after, or the few days later, we got invited to do Sledgehammer, Peter Gabriel. And we thought, oh, it's come to this. But we end up doing pop videos. But it was a good experience. And then immediately after that, the world of publicité came in.
Commercials.
Yeah. And we started doing commercials, which were amazingly lucrative. And we realized that if we did one a year, it would allow us to work. One commercial would take 6 weeks. We'd have another 46 weeks to do our own work. So it was a sort of payoff with the devil that
it would allow us to survive. And invariably, sometimes it'd be two commercials a year. So, and again, the money went almost exclusively to us because we did everything.
In 1986, you did two commercials, Honeywell Computers and Walker Scripts. These films are aesthetically different from what you did as short movies. For Honeywell Computers, this is a computer-generated graphics, the first ones. How did you work with these?
Any commercial has a scenario that's already written for you. I mean, what they then do is ask for your collaboration, and inevitably, you can suggest that we could go this way or that way. I know with the first, the Honeywell, ours, they're trying to sell Honeywell computers and by saying, if you don't want to look old fashioned and Charles Dickens, which they got us to do that, those sequences, and then they flashed ahead to a modern computer technology, CGI kind of filmmaking. And we found out afterwards that everybody preferred the old fashioned, our little bit of animation to the contemporary CGI. So in a way, we won a little contest there.
People who listen can check on YouTube because this is still on YouTube.
Is it on YouTube?
Yes. Ah. Walker Scripts 2. Aesthetically, did you want to make something different from your animated movie?
Yeah, that was... I think what we liked about that one was that they already had the music and the sound done. And it was a kind of liquid humor. And it was a challenge. I think that... that fascinated us. So we did some things like for a weed killer, Monsanto, which now has gotten into big trouble, but they said to us, so we did all three sequences, and they said, maybe we'd like you to do part two.
Explain what it's a weed killer.
Yes, I did say weed killer.
No, Roundup.
It's Roundup.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a weed killer. It's quite lethal. People are dying of it, but at the time they thought only the weeds were dying, but when we made when they proposed that we might do the second part, they said, this time let's not be so sentimental towards the weeds. Sympathetic.
In commercials, are you given carte blanche?
Never carte blanche, but they give a brilliant scenario. I mean, really, truly, sometimes brilliant. They just put it through our filter of how it should look. I mean, we did something for Badois. The French came over to us, and we did two parts, and. And they were based on La Fontaine. So they were very happy.
Do you consider your commercial as part of your cinematographic work?
Yeah, absolutely. Because in a way, you have to respect the world of advertising, because sometimes it can be brilliant. You know, the majority of the times it's dire. It's not very interesting, but you know, when the scripts are good, you just say, I think we can acquit this and make something very good and respectable.
Let's listen to one of your commercial works. So for the camera company Nikon in 1989 Fun Touch campaign, in it you bring to life all cameras that observe a small modern camera whose advertising promotes.
Oi, what you got there, Norman?
It's the Fun Touch.
Don't tell me. It squirts water.
Actually, it's a Nikon.
The business.
Norman! Trevor!
Say cheese.
Fingers?
I think that we're fascinated because, again, it's about the cinema. So the use of cameras and moving cameras on tripods, and I mean the dialogue is stupid, but to bring the voices alive with the movement of the cameras, and to discover what each camera could do as a voice was the challenge.
And at times it's you're given quite a large budget for the art department, so there's always the great pleasure of going out to secondhand camera shops and finding characters instead of looking for a fat man and a thin man. You find different kinds of cameras and that sort of range of character. So it was a huge amount of fun. So I think when the camera people, a shop, the two of us would come into it and we'd be there working out all the different, what tricks could it do? And they're thinking, what the hell are these guys doing?
We will now listen to some music. In 1999, a BBC producer, Rodney Wilson, put you in touch with the legendary Karl-Heinz Stockhausen for the joint production of a film called In Absentia. So after listening to the music, can you tell us how was this collaboration with Stockhausen?
In short, there was no discussion with him initially. We had to send him a number of films just so he could approve them, which he did. And then we were told that through the Rodney Wilson that the music, this was in April, and we were told that the music would arrive on August 21st at 12 o'clock noon, and it did. And at that time, we had ideas what the music would sound like, because we've known Stockhausen's music. And so these camera tests were carried out knowing what it might sound like. And when it arrived, I remember both of us sitting down with this magnetic tape, and we played it to one of the camera tests, and we slid it something like 25 frames one way or the other, and it was an absolute sync. And so we thought, okay, we know how to film this now.
So this was like a kind of a music video of a music clip?
No,
in the process of making?
The commission was that the BBC had was going to commission the composers first. So the music, each composer had to create 20 minutes of music. Then the directors were brought on board to deal with the music. So it was the Dutch composer Louis Andriessen was given Hal Hartley. John Tavener was given to Werner Herzog. Nicholas Roeg had the music of Portishead, And then Stockhausen's music, we had the call to do Stockhausen. So it was very, so it was sort of an inversion. Most people don't tend to work with the music first, but for us it was perfect.
You also collaborated with a large number of avant-garde artists on the development of music videos. With his name is Live, 16 Horsepower, Paul Dennis Miller, alias DJ Spooky, and film music composer Michael Penn. Working on a music video is perfect for you since you have the music first.
I mean, I know with his name is Alive, he initially contacted, was it us or somebody, about he just wanted to use an extract from Street of Crocodiles, and we said no. We'll do something specifically for you if you pay us, but but we weren't going to let you have Street of Crocodiles. So his production company, was it 4AD?
4AD.
Said here's 10,000 pounds. What can you do with 10,000 pounds? So that's how that happened. And then we got to do part two a couple of years later. But normally it's the we had an agency in Los Angeles, also one in London, but occasionally the music would come in and then we would be given the music, would we like to do it? So we had a choice. Some we rejected, some we didn't. We did them. But again, I think it was, it's again, the feeling is, did the music feel cinematic? Could you make it work with, and I think particularly his name was Alive, was the one I think that we felt, it was more cinematic, it felt it.
And for you, short movies, such as Street of Crocodiles, we also for Instinct Anatomies, Ex Voto, The Camp, The Artificially Perspectiva, etc. You work with a composer like Jankowski. So in this case, do you have more control on the music?
With Lech, we never ever once told him. It was always a surprise, and we just adapted to it, and that was fine. That was wonderful.
I think he had an unerring instinct for anticipating what we would like and vice versa. And then we were completely at liberty to say, surprise us. And that was the provocation. Apart from Benjamin, when we said a chorus of children, that was the only thing we ever insisted upon.
So we're going to listen to a bit of Jankowski music for Street of Crocodiles. Few more questions. Do you go to the movies a lot nowadays?
Often, probably not as vigorously. Our days are long, so sometimes at the end of a day you're pretty exhausted.
What are you doing in your days?
Well, if you're doing the animation and building and all that, so even on we tend to work Saturdays and Sundays.
I mean, we have quite a large DVD collection, so you're always reviewing films, always. And then we talk about them, but you're always measuring the distance between when you first saw the film 30 years ago to when you see it now, or maybe, and you're always measuring what it is that you, what you love about it, or what you will always love about it. No, it's a good history lesson. You're always reviewing.
But I know we're seeing, I mean, we go to film festivals occasionally, which invariably are animation festivals. But you see also what's being done on a festival like in Leipzig, which we just returned from. You see what's being done in the documentary. You see and a lot what's being done in animation. So you're staying abreast of movements. I mean, we read certain cinema magazines, and you see, oh, such and such a film has come out. This one has no dialogue; it's only music. So, of course, we're fascinated, and we do see experimental films. I mean, in a way, they're probably closer to the area that we prefer to operate in now.
Is it still possible, meaningful, to make stop motion movies in our digitalized world?
I mean, it's also a generation gap, because I mean the kids who are working with CGI and in the digital world can look back and at say traditional animation, which is not, doesn't mean traditional. Schweinkmeier isn't traditional. He does achieve it, in a militant manner, with you know his hands and the hands of his animators. So I think it's a little bit false to say that, or to think that the digital side is preeminent now. I mean, there's probably more people using it because it's available tools with the computer and all that. But a lot of them, they're not filmmakers; they're just technicians in the service of something else.
I think also that when people watch, say, puppet animation by us, they can see that we work very strongly with organic material, and that's something that CGI cannot. You can smell the difference instantly. Everybody can, and I think it's amazing how the brain so quickly
knows
it exactly, feels it in the cortex of the marrow of their whole bone system, that this is CGI. Everybody relaxes a little bit when you see sort of the organic world and real three-dimensional space being used, and I don't mean like 3D, but the third real dimensional space. I think everybody, depends how good it is, but you respond very powerfully physically with that kind of animation.
Do you feel like prehistorical directors?
I don't know. You have to tell us. I think we feel pretty youthful about the work, and that there's much to explore there. I think the thing is that. That yes, you say the Quays, they do puppet animation, but it's an easy description. I mean, they may use puppets, but they use them in a way that extends or floats another world, that it isn't just an easy vehicle for charming people, but that, and I, again, I think it comes back to trying to create this in-between world between where you feel that there's the power of live action, the power of animation, but we're floating something very much in the middle.
You finished The Doll's Quest, your last short animated movie, which can only be seen in 35mm. What are your next projects?
We began an animation film on Bruno Schultz's story, This Sanatorium Under the Sign of the Hourglass, which we've done something like 20 minutes of filming, and so we'd like to return to finishing that. So that's
we're looking for
money, of course, but
it's a feature.
It'd be a feature.
So your third feature?
A short feature.
Short feature?
No, something like, you know, 80 minutes.
But it's meant to be a mixture of live action and animation. So we wanted to court both worlds. One is inserted inside the other and vice versa. But again, you need a substantial budget for that. So that's what's happening as we speak. We're looking for money.
Do you want to end on this call for money?
No, it's a subject, the Bruno Schultz. I mean, we're also doing a kind of installation at the Rotterdam Film Festival this year. We've been invited. And what we're doing is we're exploring some of the themes from the Bruno Schultz story, Sanatorium Under the Sand of the Hourglass. And so it's creating, an installation which we're hoping will sort of both announce the project but take you in a slightly different direction.
So thank you very much, Stéphane and Timothy Quay, d'avoir participé à ce nouveau grand entretien de Négatif. Négatif, c'est aussi un site internet, négatif.co, où vous pouvez découvrir la biographie des invités, des extraits vidéo des films, ainsi que des liens pour approfondir le sujet. N'hésitez pas à nous suivre sur vos applications de podcast, sur Spotify et sur YouTube, et à vous abonner sur les réseaux sociaux. À bientôt.